Hi, this is Scott. I really appreciate our sponsors because they make the show possible. Today's show is sponsored by Developer Express. Become a UI superhero with DevExpress, controls, and libraries. Deliver elegant .NET solutions that address customer needs today by leveraging your existing knowledge. You can build next-generation touch-enabled solutions for tomorrow. You can download your free 30-day trial at dx.hanselminutes.com. That's dx.hanselminutes.com.
From HanselMinutes.com, it's Hansel Minutes, a weekly discussion with web developer and technologist Scott Hanselman. This is Lawrence Ryan announcing show number 474. In this episode, Scott talks with Dr. Sue Black about saving the historic Bletchley Park.
Hi, this is Scott Hanselman. This is another episode of Hansel Minutes, and today we have the pleasure of talking with Dr. Sue Black. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Hi, thanks very much for talking to me.
Yeah, I learned about you not because of all of your other great work that you have done, but specifically about Bletchley Park, because I went and saw the movie, The Imitation Game, and was really struck by the story, and then tweeted about it, and then through a number of kind of great tweets, found out that the movie that I saw is in no way a documentary.
True. Yeah, I mean, isn't that amazing? The great power of Twitter. I have to say straight off that I absolutely love Twitter, and Twitter was absolutely fundamental in the stuff that we did in trying to save Bletchley Park. So, yeah, Twitter's cool.
Yeah, I was one of those things where you and I would tweet each other, and then people that we each knew would say, "You guys did you know each other?" Oh, you know, it seems like a little cocktail party where people get to meet and people get to listen in on other people's conversations.
Yeah, absolutely. I think of Twitter as like a big party, but you can listen in on everybody's conversations, right? So that's so cool. And it was really cool because I didn't know you and you didn't know me, but loads of people knew both of us. So yeah, I thought that was great.
Yeah, it's fantastic. So this movie, the Imitation Game, is a dramatization, and it has Benedict Cumberbatch, and it talks about Alan Turing and the work that was done not just by him, but by many, many people to solve the enigma. Can you talk about why this, you know, what this movie expresses and why it's problematic?
Well, I guess, I mean, my review basically stated that I both loved it and I hated it at the same time, the film. And I guess I'll start with the reasons I hated it. And that was just because it told the story in a very kind of simplistic way. It got lots of facts wrong. It was a bit clunky in parts where, for example, like the guy who was Turing's boss in the film was portrayed as this kind of evil guy. You know, it's like you must have an evil guy in a film, right? Who's kind of there doing bad things. Whereas in fact, his boss was great, you know, and, surely the evil guy should have been Hitler, not Turing's boss who was trying to, help win the war and save lives. So it was a bit clunky and kind of a bit, you know, it grated a bit, I suppose. And especially having met some of the people, relatives of the people involved. So in particular, this guy who was Turing's boss, I've met his grandson. And so, you know, I know that his family were really upset about the portrayal of their granddad in the film. And, you know, so this guy that was a hero is portrayed in the film as a villain. And it just, there's just lots of, you know, bits and pieces like that, which just weren't true. And surely the real story is good enough on its own. Why do you have to change it like that? So that was kind of, there were several negative things like that. And kind of everything was, obviously Turing was amazing, but it's like every major achievement was kind of made out that Turing made every single major achievement at Bletchley Park, whereas there were 10,000 people working there. And also most of the people that worked there were women. And so that wasn't really portrayed in the film. So I could go on and on and on.
I'd like you to go on and on and on. That's why you're on the
okay.
show.
Yeah. Okay. Cool. So.
Well, maybe we could talk for people who aren't familiar, but what is it important about the Enigma and the Lorenz ciphers? And what was so important about the government code and cipher school?
Well, so basically, Bletchley Park was set up to break the German codes. And so Enigma and Lorenz were two of the machines that the Germans used. Yeah, Bletchley Park was set up there with, at the kind of the highest point with about 10,000 people working there, all working together to crack the codes. And, you know, it was one of the major achievements of the Second World War, but everyone there was completely sworn to secrecy. And in fact, they were kind of, not exactly threatened, but they were kind of shown somebody with a gun who would shoot them if they told anybody what was happening, and they had to sign the Official Secrets Act. And it was, you know, like I was saying before, it was mainly women, and most of the code breakers were men, but it was like a big kind of industrialized code breaking process. And most of the people running those machines, which were the, like the bomb machine, and Colossus, which were there as the code breaking, machines. Most of those machines were run by all those women. And the women actually were almost girls, because most of them were about 18 to 20. So they, you know, they were very young women. And so, you know, the film didn't get any of that across at all. And I suppose, you know, why should the film portray everything exactly as it was? But I think it's important to tell that story, especially when it hasn't really been told before. You know, if we'd seen lots of films about that were much more truthful about what had gone on before, we would already know the true story. But because this is like the first major film, about what happened at Bletchley Park, really, there is the film Enigma, but that wasn't really true to life either. So, because it's the first major film, it's like a massive opportunity to tell this amazing story. But what it actually did was told a story that was a bit like the truth, but not really, and kind of it just made it much too simple and didn't really give credit to lots of the people that really helped. And, you know, So you get annoyed about that stuff if you know the true story.
Well, when a movie comes out about a particular topic like this, it's an opportunity, and it's also a moment in time where there's not going to be another Bletchley Park Enigma movie for some number of years until someone does it again. And it's really important, I think, for listeners to know that it's not just that, oh yeah, well, there's some women involved and the women didn't get credited. 80% of the people working there, plus like thousands, 9,000 women. This isn't like 50-50 or 90-10. I mean, 80%+. It was mostly women doing this work. And in the film, there was largely one woman, Joan Clark, played by Keira Knightley, who was present.
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, you can see why anyone that knows the story would get a bit annoyed about that. But so what I said in my review was that, so for those reasons, I hated it. But at the same time, of course, I absolutely loved it, because, you know, they're on the big screen with, you know, top actors up there for Oscars. Is this major film which tells some of the story of what happened at Bletchley Park. So, of course, I loved it for that reason, you know, because it's really getting the message out there to an audience, most of whom won't really have known what did happen there. And so even just getting the name Bletchley Park out there will I know that it did. It increased the number of visitors going up to Bletchley Park, but, you know, quite dramatically. So, you know, it's great that it's done that. But at the same time, that's kind of balanced out with all these things that, you know, it is a good story. Why change it?
Mm-hmm. And so you say that it has changed the number of visitors. I mean, I know that I was familiar with Bletchley Park, but now after seeing it, it makes me want to go there and actually stand there.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that's the great sort of long-term thing that the film will do, really.
Mm-hmm. Was cryptography, and please forgive my ignorance, but this is why I had you on the show, was it a really well understood thing in the late 30s, early 40s?
Well, gosh, that's a good question. I don't actually know the answer to that. I mean, I think the people that they got up there from, you know, like the major UK universities. So some people were experts in cryptography. Other people were experts in languages, of course, like Japanese, German. So I'm not an expert at wartime cryptography, I'm afraid. But if you want me to find someone to come on your show next time, then I'll find them for you.
No, that would be a fine idea. I think that, the mythology of Turing and why the movie changed the story, you know, as a piece of fiction is really interesting, because certainly he was persecuted based on his lifestyle and then, of course, recently given a formal apology. But do you think it was because
he was a singular man that they decided to make the entire focus on him and erase the rest of the other people? Or would you think it was because of the persecution? Why is it we are so obsessed with Turing that we would give him the credit of the work of 12,000 plus people?
Well, I think he's more widely known than any of the other code breakers to start with. So there's that. I think also, for some reason, we kind of get a bit obsessed with people who die young. And also just the whole kind of like heart wrenching, his whole story, you know, you can just imagine this guy who was phenomenally clever, who most people didn't really understand. But I mean, I think he was respected at Bletchley Park, but it's kind of outside of that kind of world that maybe he wasn't so much. And that's where, you know, like the police getting involved and all of that, and just how everything was in those times is just horrendous, isn't it, to us today, to think that that's actually not really that long ago that people were treated like that. I mean, I find it disgusting, really. But just his whole kind of story, you know, this poor guy who, you know, had a brain the size of a planet, was really, really smart, really tried hard to do the best for his country. You know, he was just like, I don't know, like a almost like a superhero kind of guy. So of course everyone kind of, that resonates with everybody, but at the same time he was treated so badly. Mm-hmm. and then, you know, ended up dying at a young age. It's just like, you know, that's kind of the stories that films are, you know, films and books are written about and films are made about, because it's just so kind of tragic. Mm-hmm. I guess
it's an easy plot foil to just say, ah, the hero, the anti-hero, the protagonist, we found them, and then you just wrap the entire story around it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, so I mean, but hopefully another thing that it'll do is it'll make people aware of the fact that there is more to the story. There were, you know, lots of other code breakers there. Lots of other stuff happened. And so, you know, what I'm really hoping is that as time goes on, other films will be made which look at different aspects. So, for example, I first got involved with Bletchley Park in 2003, and that was when I went up there for a meeting and found out on that day that actually 10,000 people had worked there and that more than half of them were women. And that's how I got involved. And so I then was looking around for funding to try and fund an oral history project of the women that worked there, because being a woman working in technology for 20 years, I had no clue that any women worked at Bletchley Park at all. You know, mm-hmm. So that story just had not been told. And so my first involvement really was trying to highlight the contribution of the women, and that, you know, that started kind of coming out more and more. There are about 3 books come out recently about the women that worked at Bletchley Park. So I think these things just take time. You know, I always want stuff to happen really quickly, but in actuality, you know, it all takes a long time, really, mm-hmm. for it all to happen.
Well, and one of the things also is that there were so many women who worked on this whose work was classified by the Official Secrets Act of 1939. So, you know, Margaret Rock died in 1983, but no one really knew what she'd done until that information was declassified, you know, when she was an old person.
Yeah, absolutely. And some people died, you know, like Tommy Flowers, who invented Colossus, you know, to break Lorenz. So he, I think, not really in his whole lifetime did he get properly recognized for the stuff that he'd done. And mm-hmm. and someone told me a story of how he, I think in the 70s, signed up for a class to learn how to use a computer. And it's like, he bloody invented the computer. But, you know, he signed up for a class to learn how to use the computer. I can't remember exactly what was said, but it was just like quite patronizing the way that he was talked to there, because of course, no one knew that he'd, you know, invented the first programmable digital computer, because that had been done, you know, like, 70s, 30 years before, and it was still secret. So, you know, and there are just so many stories like that of people that have made major contributions but never been able to talk about it. And so the ones that are still around now can talk about it, but of course loads of people died before that was lifted.
I want to take a moment to thank our sponsor, SyncFusion. SyncFusion's mobile, web, and desktop controls are trusted worldwide. But did you know that they also provide educational resources? The Succinctly series of free ebooks has great content on popular technologies in 100 completely ad-free pages. These books are written by industry experts, and topics range from Cassandra to Node.js to Windows 8.1. They are available for Kindle apps and in PDF format, and new ebooks are released each month, so browse their library at syncfusion.com to download your free ebook today. One of the things that I was surprised about was not just the gender aspects, but also the distances in ages. You had different women codebreakers at Bletchley Park. Joan Clark came out with a double degree in mathematics in like 23, I think, when she came to Bletchley Park. Well, Margaret Rock, another woman codebreaker, showed up around her 37th birthday. So we had a very wide range of experiences, a wide range of degrees, a lot of them in mathematics, all working towards one thing.
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the kind of great things about Bletchley Park was that because there was such a massive threat from Hitler, and, you know, just from the country being at war, everyone pulled together, and, you know, everyone was just desperate to find the best people to do stuff. And so in a way, it wouldn't really matter who anybody was. They just wanted the best people to do it. And I suppose that's why it kind of brought together a sort of a mixed group of people, I suppose, to make that happen.
And that mix of people, they all had different skills. One of the funny things about Joan Clark was that she was promoted to the rank of linguist, but in fact had no skill in languages and would fill out questionnaires and say, you know, pay grade, linguist, languages, none.
Yeah, oh,
she was a mathematician. Were her bosses trying to give her power, but were having to work within a power structure that did not allow a woman to be
I'm guessing so. Yeah, I mean, I've heard that story and I can't remember exactly, but I'm guessing that it is that kind of thing, that it just was impossible to do it any other way.
Yeah. She was promoted to deputy head of Hut 8 in 1944 and was the only woman at Bletchley Park to reach that senior level from a cryptographic perspective.
Right.
Yeah, it's absolutely amazing. So you are actively working on making sure that Bletchley Park does not get forgotten, and you're trying to use social media to do this.
Sure. Well, so basically, as I was saying before, like, I went there the first time in 2003. Came away having found out that more than 10,000 people worked there, and also that more than half of them were women, wanting to raise the profile of those women, find out more really about what happened. And at the launch of, so we ran this project, the Women of Station X, and so another name for Bletchley Park is Station X because it was the 10th listening station as part of the code-breaking effort. So we got some funding, we interviewed some women that worked there, and then at the launch of our project in 2008, the director of Bletchley Park at the time, Simon Greenish, gave a talk, and he said that they were, well, his words were, they were teetering on a financial knife edge, so he wasn't sure if they would be able to stay open. And so I kind of, you know, we had the launch, and it was all great of this project, but I kind of went home thinking, well, that's not right. Why have they not got enough money? And then like a few weeks later, I was invited up to Bletchley Park to a reception. And then I did a full tour, which I'd not done before, because it's a 26-acre site, I think. So, you know, it's a big site with lots of huts, the mansion house, the lake. And so I did a proper tour around with a veteran who'd worked there, telling us all about what he'd done and stories of other people. And just, it was really just so interesting. And I kind of had this moment where I was standing looking at Hut 6, which at the time was kind of covered at one end with a blue tarpaulin because there was, you know, to stop water leaking in because the roof had holes in it. So looking at this hut, and the veteran was telling us about the major code-breaking achievements that happened in that hut. And I just thought back to what Simon Greenish had said about them not having enough money. And I just thought, this is ridiculous. All these major code breaking achievements. And the work done there is said to have shortened the war, by 2 years. And it's like, you know, it's a really fundamental place, in terms of computer science with Turing, working there, being sort of the father of computer science. And I just thought, and this place might close. That's ridiculous. Mm-hmm. You know, I've got to do something about it. So I went away, basically. And at that time, I was head of a computer science department at the University of Westminster in London. And so I basically emailed all the heads and professors of computing in the UK and said, you know, this is a disgrace. At the time, there was a petition on the 10 Downing Street website. the Prime Minister's office, which someone else had set up, saying we must save Bletchley Park. And so I pointed all the heads and professors at this petition and said, you know, please sign the petition. We've got to save Bletchley Park. So I sent that email out. It was quite a new head of department, so I was a bit scared, actually, that they would come back and say, who do you think you are? Because I'd probably been in post like 6 months or something. But actually, it was great. So I looked at the petition a few hours later. Loads of, like, to me, famous heads and professors of computing from around the UK, people whose textbooks I'd used as a student, had signed the petition. So I thought, okay, it's not just me that feels like this. Lots of other people do too, and, you know, lots of my peers. So then I and a colleague at University of Westminster wrote a letter to the Times and sent that round, asking all these heads and profs to sign the letter to the Times. So then that went into the Times. And at the same time, I contacted the BBC and said, you know, I think I've got a story. And so basically what happened was we ended up on the BBC News and in the Times newspaper with the letter to the Times on the same day. So that was in 2008. And that kind of went international. So that was really cool. But what I realized after that was that something that's news one day is not news the next day. And, you know, I'm not a PR person or advertising or marketing or anything. You know, I'm a computer science academic, right? So I don't really know what to do next. And I suppose what happened a few months after that was I started using Twitter and then realized quite quickly that actually that was a very good way to reach lots of people very quickly and find people that were interested in Bletchley Park, because even the simplest thing is to put, you can put Bletchley Park in and find everyone who's tweeting about it, you know. So very quickly, you can find people, you can build up a community, you can talk to those people, you can make stuff happen. And so basically then ran a campaign using Twitter in the main to make people aware of their situation. And got various celebrities involved and ran a campaign over about 3 years, really. Eventually getting Google involved. Google helped out. And in 2011, the director said that Bletchley Park was saved. So basically, they, you know, they were on an even keel financially.
And do you think it's sustainable now?
Yeah, so absolutely. So, and since then, they've got 4.1 million heritage lottery funding, so like some substantial funding, and they've renovated many of the huts. And so, you know, it was a cool place to visit when it was kind of falling apart because it was a bit ramshackle. But now they've done lots of work, and it's you know, some really state of the art, some great stuff there. Like, for example, walking into the hut where Turing used to work, you walk into the rooms and they've got like voices, so they've got kind of audio, so they've got voices like having a conversation about code breaking as you walk in, and then you sort of see images projected onto the wall of people talking to each other. It's very kind of like, it's really evocative of the Second World War, so it really does give you that feeling that, oh my goodness, yes, this was the place where it all happened. It kind of, you know, sends tingles down your spine.
That's amazing. Yeah, Turing worked in Hut 8. And looking online, there's pictures of these huts 10 years ago,
right?
2004, 2005. And honestly, it looks like a poorly maintained children's summer camp. You know what I mean? It looks like your uncle's bad garage, you know, that building that's out back that just needs to be knocked down.
Yeah, exactly. So when I talked to the BBC, I remember saying it looked like a garden shed that hadn't been looked after. So maybe that's the English equivalent.
Yeah, absolutely. But now you've got big prominent signs that express, you know, what the significance of each building is and why they're important. And they've even got the, you know, bar and restaurant next to the mansion, and it is a proper museum, and we can go and visit.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's been open the whole time, but I think as time goes on, it becomes more and more like a proper national museum.
Mm-hmm. If people should do this, and I'll put links in the show notes, but you should look at the size of these devices, like the, and is it pronounced bomb?
Bomb, yeah.
Bomb, the E is silent.
Yeah.
It's massive. I mean, it's multiple refrigerator size device here. And to think that I can presume that the pocket supercomputer that I have next to me here, my iPhone, is literally many tens of thousands of times faster.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, they just look amazing. And actually, the first time I went, that's what I saw that really got me very excited, was about 10 guys working away halfway through rebuilding the bomb machine, because all the machines were destroyed at the end of the war. And the plans were destroyed as well. So I think it took them 8 or 10 years, like about 20 people, to rebuild the bomb machine. Yeah, absolutely.
Using and having to find those parts or craft those parts.
Yeah, absolutely. So they found some, and some had to be remade because there'd been a change from imperial measurements to metric in the UK, you know, in between, the time when the original one was built. So, lots of parts they just didn't exist anymore, so they had to actually have them made properly.
That's amazing. And now you have a if I understand correctly, a book coming out this spring called Saving Bletchley Park. How is that going?
Yeah, that's cool. Well, so I've finished writing my part, so which is cool and a relief. It should be out in July is the timing we're saying at the moment. So that basically tells the story of the campaign. So this kind of stuff that I've just been talking about that we did with the BBC, with Twitter, getting people involved. It tells the story all the way through, the kind of adventures that I had along the way from 2003, 2008 up to the present day. And that's kind of intercut with the story of what happened at Bletchley Park during the war. So, you know, you kind of get the two weaving in and out of each other, telling the story. So starting at the beginning of the war and people going up to Bletchley Park is one narrative, and the other narrative is me going up there, you know, to start with and finding out about the place. And so those two stories are woven together into what hopefully will make a very interesting book. Everyone that's read it so far has said it's great. So, yeah, fingers crossed.
Do you have a favorite other book around Bletchley Park? Like, you know, there's certainly the 95 novel Enigma by Robert Harris. It's a little more fictionalized. There's a lot of different plays. What's your favorite that you would recommend people go and learn about?
Well, actually, it's not specifically about Bletchley Park, but there's a book called Colossus, which is the just people that actually worked there or worked on projects to do with Colossus. It's their actual stories of what they did and stuff. So I said, but maybe coming from a computing background, I just love to actually read people write down what they did and what happened. And it's really a collection of those kind of accounts all around Colossus. That's probably my favorite.
Mm-hmm. And that's the book by B. Jack Copeland?
By Jack Copeland, yeah.
Right. So that book is Colossus, The Secrets of Bletchley Park's Code-Breaking Computer. So this is a collection of kind of told in a suspenseful tone, but with the real people telling the stories about what really happened there when they were still
absolutely.
Around.
Yeah, what they did and how they were involved and stuff.
Mm-hmm. And is it pretty technical? Does it get into some of the details?
I think it's got some technical stuff in it, but I think a general reader would be fine with it.
Very cool. That's fantastic. And what do you think that Americans should think about Bletchley Park? Because I know that there's a deep amount of passion from a UK perspective and as a source of national pride. If I'm in the UK or visiting, is this a must-see place for an American?
Well, you know, I'm biased.
but I would expect absolutely. No less.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think it was 300 Americans that did work at Bletchley Park, so it wasn't just British that were there. So there were 300 Americans, and there's a chapter in my book about that. I mean, the thing is, it's the story of the peace that we have today, you know, the peace in our time. And, you know, the US was very much a part of that happening. So, no, it's not just about Britain. It's about, you know, all of us being able to live our lives in freedom today. That's how I see it anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So calling back to the very beginning of the conversation, we are understanding now that the movie was not really well represented of reality. And there was this boss who was presented as really kind of the bad guy in the film. Who was that gentleman?
Yeah, that was Commander Denniston, who was in charge of Bletchley Park. And he's portrayed in the film as a bit of an ogre. And like, you know, he's trying to force Turing to finish working, and he's going to cut his funding if he doesn't get what's called Christopher in the film, which is actually the bomb machine. If he doesn't get that working in time, and there's a lot of kind of toing and froing and sort of angsting and stuff all around trying to make that happen. Whereas actually, I don't think any of that's true. And Commander Denniston, you know, was not an ogre. He was a good boss in charge of Bletchley Park. So it just seems a bit crazy portraying him as a bad person when he's in charge of the whole place. It doesn't make sense.
He was someone who was himself a cryptographer, recognized that code breaking was important, and consciously kept code breaking through World War One, all the way up into World War Two, and through World War Two. While in the film, it seems like he's begrudgingly allowing these guys to sit in a, you know, like four people to sit in a hut and work on code breaking.
When that's what they were all there for. So it just really doesn't make sense. Yeah, it doesn't make sense.
Yeah, the whole point of this installation is to crack this code, and there's 12,000 of us here doing it, but it's four people in a garage that saved the universe.
Yeah.
Well, hopefully people will familiarize themselves not just with Alistair Denniston, with Joan Clark, with Turing, but with all the great stuff that happened at Bletchley Park. There's lots of fiction and nonfiction around the space, and I think it's important for us as computer people and computer scientists to be able to tell the difference between the truth and the fiction.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, people like Bill Tutt and Tommy Flowers spring to mind, who've made absolutely major achievements and are starting to get a bit of recognition, but basically most people have never heard of them still.
Mm-hmm. Well, thanks so much for chatting with me today.
You're welcome.
Well, folks can check out Dr. Sue Black online. She's active on Twitter, and her book coming very, very soon is Saving Bletchley Park. And I will include links in the show notes to all of those things.
That's wonderful. Thank you so much.
Absolutely my pleasure. I really enjoyed talking with you today.
You too.
This has been another episode of Hansel Minutes, and we'll see you again next week.